From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and ever since I was a little kid, dreaming of being a broadcaster when I grew up, I wanted to be like my favorite anchorman, Ron Burgundy. Burgundy's career was, of course, the subject of the 2004 movie Anchorman, The Legend of Ron Burgundy, which showed just how good he was at keeping it classy.
After the photo mat was destroyed, the bear scampered back into the woods.
Apparently, he wasn't too happy with his color prints.
From the entire Channel 4 news team, I'm Veronica Corningstone.
And I'm Ron Burgundy. Go f*** yourself, San Diego.
What in the name?
No!
Ron Burgundy is back in the new movie Anchorman 2. And we're going to keep it classy by talking about the soundtrack of Anchorman 2 with one of the film's two composers. We've also got live music from Seasick Mama, a surprisingly classy project from singer, songwriter, model, and artist Mariel Marr. The video for her song Man Overboard is practically a movie itself and looks like it probably had a budget close to that of Anchorman 2. Seasick Mama will be doing a stripped-down but plugged-in set for us later. But to begin,
I hid in the cloud and wrath of the crowd. When they said sit down, I stood up.
Bruce Springsteen adorns the cover of a new book by photographer Lynn Goldsmith called Rock and Roll Stories. It's a collection of her photos and the tall tales that come with them from a career that's lasted over four decades. All the stars are here, from her one-time boyfriend, Bruce Springsteen, to James Brown, from Bob Dylan to the Rolling Stones, and on to Michael Jackson, New Kids on the Block, and many, many more. Lynn Goldsmith's career has also included some music of her own, though you may know it under a different name, as we'll see in a bit. And her career is the subject of a PBS documentary coming in the new year. Right now, Lynn Goldsmith joins us in the Soundcheck studio. Welcome.
Oh, thanks, John. I'm really happy to be at Soundcheck and with you.
Let me start, not even at the beginning, but before you get to the beginning of the book, the cover, this sort of almost iconic image of Bruce Springsteen wearing this leather jacket, which we then see later in the book, lots of other people wearing this jacket too.
Yeah, in the days when I started photographing a number of musicians, there was really no such thing as stylists or hair and makeup people. And my work has always been about it. It actually started when I was photographing my dolls at age 8, where I would redress them and give them an identity. And so when I started doing this with my friends, in fact, many of them became successful musicians. Mm-hmm. But I used to just play with it. You know, we'd play. I'd do hair, makeup, take pictures. They'd take pictures of me. And that's how it got going. That jacket was a jacket which actually I wore in my band in 1966, The Walking Wounded, mm-hmm. in Ann Arbor, Michigan. So I used to use my own clothes on a number of people, which goes to show you that those guys weren't exactly big guys.
And that jacket is now where?
Well, that's the funny part of the story. At one point in time, Bruce and I tried breaking into the Elvis Museum, which is at that time was Elvis's home.
In Graceland.
Yeah, in Graceland. And we were thrown out twice that night. In 2000, I was invited to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame because they were honoring me there. And there was a Bruce Springsteen exhibit. And in the case was my leather jacket, which actually Bruce did not like. I got him to wear it for that picture, but he only wore it for maybe one roll of the film and wanted to take it off because the studs weren't really his style. Mm-hmm. So now it comes to 2010, 11, when I'm writing this book and I call up the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and I said, I'd like to get a picture of the case and tell the story. And they said, oh, well, we'd love to give it to you, but we loan that exhibit out to the Elvis Museum. You'll have to call them. there. I said, is that in Graceland? And they said, yeah. And I went, wow, this is fantastic. I finally got into Graceland.
Now, so in addition to bringing your own clothing occasionally to your photo shoots, you have a picture here somewhere in the book of Frank Zappa holding one of your dolls.
Oh, yeah, I used my dolls. Actually, I continue to use dolls, and you'll see them in photographs, whether it's with Zappa, Sting. I mean, pretty much everybody. Barbie got to have as much fun as I did.
So some people would naturally be more comfortable in front of the camera than others. When you got to somebody, say, like Michael Jackson, you have, you know, who was famously shy, you have this great picture, this little psychedelic picture of him dancing.
Yes.
What's he dancing to? Did you bring an audio prop for him?
Yes, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I have only ever shot one person, which is the author, Isaac Bashevis Singer, when I did not use music.
Really?
Yes. It's not just for the artist and to create. You need to create an environment because the job of a good portrait photographer is to hopefully become someone's new best friend immediately.
Okay, so now you're talking about an actual photo shoot, not like, you know, casual photos backstage or on stage or things like that. You're talking about things where you've set up the room. That's where you would bring music.
Well, actually, even I pretty much used to carry a boombox, even a
really?
Small one, a pink one. It's in it, and I talk about that in the book. So even if I'm backstage, there are moments where I can throw on my boombox and make a musical connection that changes the whole room.
Wow. Well, that photo of Michael Jackson dancing is on our website, soundcheck.org. We're speaking with Lynn Goldsmith, the photographer. Her book is called Rock and Roll Stories. It is out now. And PBS doing a documentary on you, which is premiering in January. So, but back to this Michael Jackson photo. What is he dancing to?
Oh, Get on the Good Foot by James Brown.
I
want
to get on the good foot.
Is that your go-to, one of your go-to pieces?
Well, James Brown, JB, you know, the godfather of soul. And even though he wasn't from Detroit, I adopted him. I mean, you know, probably my favorite singer of all time would be Aretha Franklin, but that sets a different mood. James Brown has been incredibly meaningful to me, as was Little Richard and a number of other artists that got me dancing. And the power of music to have people come out of themselves. And that is exemplified in the image of Michael Jackson, which was made at Disney World in Orlando. Michael wasn't really shy with me because I'd worked with Michael for many years. However, this was a shoot for Life magazine. And so there were people there that he had never seen before. And I could tell that he wasn't his open self. So when I put that on and said, come on, let's dance.
So you're dancing in the same
room. Oh, yeah.
Room.
I dance really well with heavy photo equipment on me.
All right. Get on the Good Foot, a song that came in handy for photographer Lynn Goldsmith when working with Michael Jackson and probably some other folks over the course of a long and illustrious career photographing some of rock and roll's biggest and best, including James Brown. Lynn, you got to work with him on a couple of occasions, right?
Yeah, the first time I met James Brown was when I was going to Zaire, Africa in 1974 for the Rumble in the Jungle. Mm-hmm. And they were also putting on a music festival.
Right.
And I was scheduled along with Bill Withers, the Pointer Sisters, and a number of other artists, great artists, to go on a private plane from New York to Africa. And the amazing thing about James Brown is that he really always thought of himself as like the man in charge.
Mm-hmm.
And he would not fly without any without his equipment. All the other artists, their equipment had to go on a different plane, and they said it was very dangerous for us to fly that way, and the plane was held up for hours. But,
because it was overladen.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was dangerous, but he didn't care.
So he almost gets you killed.
Yes, he almost gets me killed. And then,
but you do land safely.
Yeah, we do land safely. It was just the way with James. But that's why I have a first chapter called Strange Angels.
Mm-hmm.
I actually wanted to call that chapter Crazy Mother. but I thought Strange Angels was something I could say on the air and the other one wouldn't be.
Yeah.
So
thank you for that, Lynn. Lynn Goldsmith, the book is called Rock and Roll Stories. It's out now. One of the things that, you know, looking through some of these photographs, you have had an almost Zelig-like existence in the rock and roll world. You've been a fly on the wall on a number of occasions. Patti Smith famously falling off stage and breaking her neck.
Yeah, so, that's not a moment I really wanted to be a fly on the wall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, the shot of her being carted off in the ambulance.
Well, it was an interesting moment because, you see, I was on the stage. It was a very high stage. So when that's the situation, I don't want to shoot up someone's nose. So I'm actually on the stage. We were in Florida. I saw the wire there, and Patti used to do a certain kind of dance, a mm-hmm. twirling,
right.
like a dervish on one song. And I saw the wire there. And that was really a moment in my career where I had to think, am I a fly on the wall or am I going to, like, be here? The audience will see me. I wanted to run out and grab that wire, but I thought, no, she must see it. You have to trust this, you know? And unfortunately, I was wrong.
Well, I mean, but fortunately, having broken a couple of vertebrae in her neck, she was back performing with a neck brace.
With a neck brace.
I actually saw Patti Smith playing at CBGB's in the neck brace, you know, shortly after.
I was there.
Yeah, yeah. Quite a performance, too.
Yes, it was, and she ripped it off during that performance. I have something else to tell you about that performance.
Yeah.
Are you ready? Before that show, we were going to be late. I was at her house, and she's doing her boyfriend's laundry, and I'm saying, we got to go. We got to go. These are just things you... Anyway, I think JD was sick or something, and she said, you know, I don't have a drummer. And I went like, oh, my God. So let me call blah, blah, blah. And she went, no, that's okay. I'll play drums. And I said, Patti, you don't play drums.
And you're in a neck brace.
And she said, yeah, but when will I ever get another chance?
Mm.
That's the key to everything.
Yeah. Actually, it's not the only time a neck brace appears in your story because you're dancing with Tina Turner.
Yes, that comes from the chapter Photo Nightmares, where it's not that the subject is a nightmare for me, but oftentimes a situation can turn out to be one. I had photographed Tina Turner in 1975 performing at the Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami Beach. So I was really well aware, plus seeing her in performance at other times, of how when she is in concert, she keeps swinging her head around and her hair. I wanted to capture that energy, so I put together a body of music to play during our shoot where we would just be swinging our heads. As I danced with Michael, I danced with Tina. I just kept turning my head so she'd mm-hmm. turn her head, and I thought I got great shots, which, you know, I don't often feel. I always feel like, oh, I could have done better. But in this situation, I don't know if really feeling I got it was worth it, because after she left, my neck was really hurting and I had to go to the hospital and I was put in a neck brace. What I had not noticed on Tina Turner, because she had long hair, was how wide and thick her neck was. Mm. She had these neck muscles from years of swinging her head. So, yeah, that was my photo nightmare. But, you know, Tina did a great job.
Lynn Goldsmith sharing some of the tales behind her photographs in the book called Rock and Roll Stories. There's also a PBS documentary on Lynn premiering in January. She's with me on Soundcheck today. So the title of that chapter, Photo Nightmares, sort of brings up a question of, you know, were there nightmares? I mean, was there a photo shoot that just stands out in your mind as the absolute worst you ever had to deal with?
I think only once. There was only one time in my career with one artist, and I don't hesitate to say so. It was Don McLean, and it was for an album cover, which to me, when you're photographing someone for an album cover, that's a body of work that they have put together to give to their audience and hopefully to create a bigger audience for what it is they have to say. And so what you package it in should not only reflect the thought and the care that you've put inside, it should reflect it on the outside. That's mm-hmm. the way I feel when I make my work. I feel I'm serving a purpose of the artist. And when he got there, he just wanted it to be over as quickly as possible. And I said, you know, if you feel that way, I think you should leave. And he didn't. He stayed. You know, I have to give him that. But he was the only person that I literally asked to leave.
Yeah. You write in the book that he was the most unpleasant artist that you've had to work with.
Ever.
Yeah. All right. Mr. American Pie himself.
But I have to say, he didn't torture me the way Miles Davis did.
That's a funny story, too.
Yeah, Miles did torture me, but it ended up being really one of the highlights of my life.
Yeah. I want to be photographed down there by the beach. Now I want to be photographed up there by the terrace.
Oh, it was hours and hours of testing me. He did something where he said, Lynn, I want you to go upstairs. I want you to go into my closet. And in my closet, I want you to pick out exactly what you want me to wear. So I said, Mr. Davis, let me just repeat this back to you because I want to make sure it's okay with you. You want me to go upstairs because we were shooting at his house mm-hmm. and go in your closet and did you hear what I said, girl? and I want you to go through my drawers. So I go upstairs, and there I see the clothes of what appears to be, you know, a Martian, like these shoes that, people, genies who come out of urns wear or something. And I'm walking down the stairs, and he said, what are you doing up in my closet? So that was just typical of the whole day. But it ended up being a day where finally, when I was at my wit's end, he said to his son who was there, get me my horn. And his son brought him his horn, and Miles played right to my face. And all the hatred that I felt for this man just completely melted.
Your experience with music has been closer than just shooting it. You've made it. You know, you had your own band in your Michigan days with the Walking Wounded.
Yes.
Hanging out with Iggy Pop when he was getting started with his band there in Michigan as
well. Well, actually, when he was Jim Osterberg.
When he was still Jimmy Osterberg. And then in the 80s, this album came out credited to Will Powers. And here in the States, at least, it was thought that this was a Todd Rundgren production. And he did, in fact, work on it. But this was essentially you, right?
Oh, yeah. And I don't blame people. They look at you as one thing. There's so much coming at us all the time that I often feel, and that's why I can now embrace the term rock and roll photographer. Mm-hmm. I used to find repellent any label. Now I understand more fully that with the way the world is, we need to identify a person. Oh, that's a jazz artist. That's a blues artist. That's a, you know, that's a photographer. Many of the artists that you know were either writers or photographers.
Right.
A lot of photographers are also musicians.
Lynn Goldsmith being a good example. let's wrap up with adventures and success from Will Powers, Lynn Goldsmith's alter ego of some years ago. The book is out now. It's called Rock and Roll Stories, and there are plenty more stories where these came from. And by the way, a Will Powers video on soundcheck.org, so check that out. PBS documentary on Lynn Goldsmith premiering in January. Lynn, congratulations on the book, and thanks for being with us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me, John, and thanks for your listeners that stayed tuned.
Take inventory of your assets. Don't be modest or critical. Be open and objective. Get a pencil and paper. Write down every good thing about yourself you can think of.
Up next, as the release of Anchorman 2 approaches, we talk with one of the composers behind the movie, and we'll find out what it's like to write a song with comedian Will Ferrell. And later, live music from an up-and-coming young artist who calls herself Seasick Mama. This is Soundcheck.
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
Soundcheck's in a giving mood this season, and that's why, starting Monday, December 9th, we're bringing you the 12 Days of Soundcheck. What's that, you ask? Well, it's the most wonderful time of the year, of course, because every weekday you can download a free song from one of our favorite in-studio sessions from this year. It'll be a different artist every day, and a little elf, a.k.a. one of my producers, told me that artists like Dirty Projectors, Iron and Wine, and Bobby McFerrin just might be in the mix. But each song's only available for 24 hours, so visit soundcheck.org every weekday starting Monday through Christmas Eve for the 12 Days of Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Comedian Will Ferrell has brought to life some pretty interesting characters over the years, from a man who believed he was an elf...
Santa's coming to town!
Santa! Oh, my God!
...to a very high-energy cheerleader.
Who's that Spartan in my TP?
It's me!
But perhaps more than any other, it's the news anchor and jazz flute player Ron Burgundy that's become his biggest cult hit.
We got it now.
Will Ferrell as Ron Burgundy will soon be returning to theaters nationwide in Anchorman 2, The Legend Continues. John Now is one of the two composers behind the new film's soundtrack and score, and he joins me now by phone from L.A. Hi, John.
Hey, hello.
First thing I have to know is there jazz flute in this new movie?
Yeah, there's some. You know, it's not as huge as the first film, but
where it is a pivotal and very memorable scene.
Yeah, they didn't want to I think it was smart. They didn't want to just kind of rehash the
folks,
you know. So
on the other hand, you know, you do want to throw a bone to people who were big fans of that first movie.
Oh, there's a little bone.
Yeah. Okay. Now, so that brings up the subject of you and your partner, Andrew Feltenstein, composing music for the sequel. You guys didn't work on the original Anchorman, although you've worked with Will Ferrell before. Did they ask you to do any kind of occasional throwbacks to the sound of the first film?
There was a couple, you know, yes and no. I mean, we did listen to the original Anchorman theme, which we ended up not doing anything with, but I think there's a couple pieces of music that's from the first film that they actually put in that we didn't touch, but other than that, it's completely an original thing now.
Mm-hmm. So you worked with Will Ferrell on the 2012 movie Casa de mi Padre, a kind of a spoof, right, on Mexican telenovelas?
Exactly. It's exactly what it is. It's all in Spanish, English subtitles.
Mm-hmm. And it becomes quickly obvious that Will can actually sing.
Well, he's a good musician. He's like a real natural, you know. His dad's actually a musician.
Uh-huh.
I learned from him anyway, but he can sing, man. He's got pipes. So, and he goes for it. He's not afraid to, like, just belt it out.
Yeah. Know? So for this movie, you had to not just do a kind of a score, you know, background music. You actually had to write songs that would be very much in the foreground of this thing.
In Casa?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. We wrote the songs ahead of time. There's, like, what, I think 4 or 5 songs in the film. I can't remember now, but those were all, you know, done ahead of time, had the actors come in and sing them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they shot to them, so it was all pre-score, so.
Well, let's hear...
Go ahead.
Let's hear one of them. This is Will Ferrell singing the song Yo No Sé from the film Casa de Mi Padre by my guest John Now and his composing partner, Andrew Feltenstein.
Vivo mi vida en la tierra. La tierra es lo que sé. Soy un ranchero y no sé nada. No sé nada.
From the movie Casa de Mi Padre, that's Will Ferrell singing in Spanish the song Yo No Sé, I Don't Know, written for him by John Now and Andrew Feltenstein, who are the two co-composers of the score for the forthcoming movie, Anchorman 2, The Legend Continues, again starring comedian Will Ferrell and directed by Adam McKay. It hits theaters on Wednesday, December 18th, although the soundtrack will be released a day early, and John Now is with us on Soundcheck on the line from L.A. So you guys had to really kind of do your homework for the sound of ranchero music and the sound of these telenovelas that the movie is spoofing, right?
We did. The director and the writer of the film, Andrew Steele and Matt Piedmont, those guys, they're total audiophiles. So they had, like, vinyl... They just made some cassettes, or not cassettes, what am I talking about? Well, they would make cassettes, they're the kind of guys that would, but they made some CDs, you know, from vinyl, like just random music, which actually I loved. It was some beautiful stuff, so kind of used that as a basis. And, mm-hmm.
And is that part of the job as a composer there in Hollywood? Is that for each film, you know, there's a different kind of sound world that you need to get into?
Absolutely. I mean, you have to find out what it is or what the director wants that world to be, and it's kind of your job is to kind of, like, bring it to life, you know?
Mm-hmm. And so what
or put a spin on it, you know?
So what's the sound world for Anchorman 2?
It's actually, it's very serious. I mean, musically it's serious. It's orchestral for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say the music's not comedic whatsoever. The music's dramatic, and you know they're funny. The music's not funny. It allows, you know, it plays off the
sure.
comedy. Works really well, and it's pretty traditional, you know, like straight up, you know, orchestra music.
So, were you going for any kind of hint of the time period of the film? I mean, at this point, we're talking about Ron Burgundy having moved from San Diego to New York to a network. It's the early '80s, right?
Yeah, you're like 79, 80.
Yeah,
absolutely. And let me rewind 1 second. Yeah, there's the orchestral element of it, and then there's like another element of the score we did that's more groove or funk or whatever you want to call it. But yeah, it's definitely of the time period.
Mm-hmm.
So
there are several different kind of layers of music to Anchorman 2.
Totally.
Okay, so there's the orchestral soundtrack. There's this more groove / funk stuff that
yep.
you've done. And then once again, as you did with Casa de Mi Padre, you had to write some songs, right?
Yeah, we did. We actually wrote, I think, in the film there's one main feature song, but we wrote probably 3 songs that are in the film,
mm-hmm.
but Will sings one of them, and then there's a couple others we did that didn't quite make the film. They're like on the... They'll be on the DVD or whatever, extras.
Right, right, the director's cut or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But the one that makes it into the film is apparently this song called Dobie.
Uh-huh.
What is or who is Dobie? What is Will Ferrell singing about here?
Well, spoiler alert, I guess.
Yeah?
No, it says he raises a shark, a white, a great white. So... That's all I can really say.
Okay. And who wrote this song? This is you and Andrew and who else?
Andrew and I wrote it, and then Adam McKay, and the director and writer of the film, or co-writer of the film, and Will Ferrell wrote the lyrics. And they just basically gave us the lyrics and said, hey, can you guys make a song out of this? And we did.
All right, so we've gotten a little bit of a sound check exclusive here. Dobie is apparently a great white shark. Here is Ron Burgundy, a.k.a. Will Ferrell, singing the song from the forthcoming movie Anchorman 2.
You swam with strength. You loved with grace. You touched us all with your expressionless face. Dobie, oh Dobie, may you find many treasures, both emotional and monetary. You were wise and loving and never contrary. Dobie, oh Dobie, I'll never forget thee.
Well, that is a great example of what John Now was talking about before. Where the movie is funny, but the music is serious. I mean, you got this, John, you've written this lovely kind of piano part with a unexpected chord progression and these ridiculous lyrics.
Yeah, exactly.
You touched us all with your expressionless face. So now this is, you guys have put this into the running for an Oscar for best song, right?
Yeah, or somebody did.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's exciting.
You're just in Under the Wire, right?
I think so, yeah. I think the deadline was just last week or something like that. But I don't know. If it even happens, that would just be unbelievable.
All right, so music by John Now, who's on the line with us, and Andrew Feltenstein. Lyrics by Will Ferrell himself and the director, Adam McKay. What is it like co-writing a song with Will Ferrell?
Those guys are so collaborative and easy to work with. I mean, Will and Adam both, I don't know, they just kind of like, we just did our thing, basically, and then play it for them. And they're like, yay or nay. You know, not even nay, I mean, they're more yay. Yeah, that's great. They're always so positive, you know, like, make a left turn here instead of a right. You know, like, maybe we can do this or amp this up a little bit. But, I don't know how else to say it except for that. It's kind of a give and take a little bit, but not really. I mean, they're open. And
right. So did you and Andrew come to them with the music first, or did they present you with the lyrics and say, here, we need a song?
It was lyrics, yeah.
Okay.
It was exactly it. That was the first, that was one of the first ones we did was that song.
Yeah.
And that led to doing the rest of the score and the rest of the film, too. They will really love the song, and I think he said he even cried listening to it.
Now, John, I read that before this sequel was going to be made, Anchorman 2, they were considering turning the first movie, Anchorman, The Legend of Ron Burgundy, into a stage musical. Were you aware of that?
No, I haven't heard that. That'd be good.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if they had come to you and said, instead of scoring another movie, we want to do a musical, I mean, would you and Andrew have been up for that?
I'd be totally into it. I mean, I would. I think it'd be a riot. That'd be incredible to try to tackle that. So,
well, for the moment, we've got the Anchorman 2 soundtrack coming out on Tuesday the 17th. The film Anchorman 2, starring comedian Will Ferrell, will hit theaters on Wednesday the 18th. John Now and his partner Andrew Feltenstein did the score for the new movie. John's been with us on the line from L.A. John, this has been fun. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it very much.
Gonna find my baby, gonna hold her tight, gonna grab some afternoon delight. My motto's always been, when it's right, why wait until the middle of a cold, dark night?
Up next, Brooklyn singer-songwriter Seasick Mama brings her twisted pop sound to our studio on Soundcheck.
You seem fine, must be tough.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Neil Young once sang about all the sailors with their seasick mamas in his 1974 song For the Turnstiles. Now, Seasick Mama has become the stage name of singer Mariel Marr, a Brooklyn artist who's got more than a few projects up her sleeve. She just put out her second EP called Tip Top Shape, produced by, in part, TV on the Radio's Dave Satek and Peter Wade of MNDR and Phantom Planet's Sam Farrar and others. Seasick Mama is here today in the studio to play a stripped-down set, starting with the song Cooked Inside Out.
I think I lost my mind, now we can't. I think I lost my mind, thanks to you. Take you by surprise on weekend, take you by surprise, it was hard to do. Oh, honey, I know we could've lit the room on fire. Burn that damn house down with both of us inside. But something caught inside me, baby, something caught inside, thanks to you. Smoke came out my mouth, dear baby, I billowed like a freight train, taking me away from you. Oh, honey, you burned me good, cooked me from the inside out. I know I should have tried to take you to bed that night.
That is a song called Cooked Inside Out from Seasick Mama. You'll find it on the new EP called Tip Top Shape, but that's a live performance, a very different kind of performance. Just Seasick Mama herself, that's Mariel Marr. Hi, Mariel.
Hi.
And Dylan Viola playing the guitar here in the Soundcheck studio. So do you prefer to be called Seasick or Ms. Mama?
A lot of people call me Seasick just to, like, poke fun because they still, like, don't understand the name.
Uh-huh.
It's so unusual.
Well, are you a Neil Young fan? Is that where the name came from?
I was a huge Neil Young fan in college. I haven't been listening to him lately just because taste changes, but I was listening to him a lot in college because my boyfriend liked him, and he called me Seasick Mama all the time.
He called you Seasick Mama.
Yeah.
Well, that's at least a unique term of endearment. looking at you online, you're Mariel Marr, you're Seasick Mama, but you're also Mariel Eve Moon. Lots of aliases. Are you on the run from something? Are you hiding something?
No, I just I do a lot of creative things, and Meryl Eve Moon is kind of my alias of as like an artist.
Hmm. So you do like graphic design,
and
and modeling,
modeling. Yeah, it's just like trying to separate my personal life somewhat.
Speaking of names, I mean, there are some pretty impressive ones joining you on this record. You know, I mentioned before Dave Satek of TV on the Radio produced the song we came in with. Yeah. And Peter Wade of MNDR and Sam Farrar, and there's another producer on the...
Mark Turgiano.
Right.
He did Dead Like Money, my first EP.
So, you know, there's always a risk when you have multiple producers like that.
Huge risk.
And yet this EP, you know, it sounds all of a piece. How did you do that?
Well, I got, you know, I got these doors open for me where I was working with all these people, so I didn't want to miss those opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went into the studio with them, I really had no idea how I wanted to sound, but I knew what, like, the message was going to be. I had a lot of poetry written. I knew how, like, vocally I wanted to sound, and the energy. That's, like, the only thing I really knew what I wanted.
Mm.
So based on those notes, like, a lot of the producers, like, knew. Like, they found music and created music that fit my personality, I guess. And magically, they all kind of... fit that was like the linear thing that held them all together. And you know, I wrote a total of like 15 songs, and these seven were like the seven that worked really well together.
Right. So it was kind of an organic way of,
it was pretty it was organic, and it was just kind of lucky, and it was just like the fun of experimenting and having the results like work. You're like, thank God.
So would you walk into the studio with a song fairly fleshed out, or did you basically have a melody and lyrics and people like, you know, Dave and
it was
Peter
always different. With Dave and Peter Wade, we had no prior relationship, so they really had no idea like what I liked. They're like, who is this girl? Like, what is she doing? So you know, we went in the studio, we shared music. That was the only way to really figure out what worked.
Share music that you like?
I could just, you know, they shared with me, like, demos that they do on their Sunday evenings, like, drinking wine or whatever. And I shared them, like, artists that I was, like, you know, that I was listening to and that I liked.
Who were some of those?
I think during the time, it was a lot of, like, Yeah Yeah Yeahs and Little Dragon, ESG, Liquid, like, some post-punk stuff.
Much of it with female vocals up
front. Yeah.
Okay.
Female. And then, but like when I was in the studio with Mark Turgiano, like we have a long relationship. So he was just like, oh my God, like let's write together because I have so much fun with you. It's just like different vibes every time.
Well, the EP is called Tip Top Shape. It was released recently. And Seasick Mama playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio today, kind of a stripped, is much different
super
sound.
Stripped.
Just you and Dylan. Mm-hmm. Now, the next song you're going to do, Man Overboard. Mm-hmm. Jay Bolger was on our show earlier this year.
Jay, I love Jay.
He's the guy who did this amazing documentary about the drummer Ginger Baker.
Yep.
And he did this, like, amazing music video for this song.
I know. He was like, well, I actually asked him to direct a music video for me before he heard the song. And he's like, there's no money in music videos. I'm not doing that. And then I sent him the music, Man Overboard. He's like, okay, like, I'll consider it. And I was like, yes, the music is speaking. Woohoo! And then he agreed to do it. And we just got lucky for a budget. And it worked out.
All right. Well, folks can check out the video online. It's the song is called Man Overboard. But let's let the music speak for itself here in the studio.
Thanks.
Seasick Mama. The song appears on the new EP, Tip Top Shape. It's called Man Overboard. This is a live performance on Soundcheck.
Tell her there's nothing between us, you.
made it crystal clear. They're you're too scared to make waves. Hey. Dirty water will exhaust you and it dies. You'll burn out fast. Don't settle the seas if you're not happy. Brave the heart of the storm and pull anchor. Cloudy weather will exhaust you and it dies. You'll burn out fast. Stop swimming circles. Sad man, he made me wait, keep your options open. Hand in hand with a sad man, what will it take? Let me know whose heart gets broken. Yo! Made it crystal clear. Yeah, you're too scared to make waves.
Live music on Soundcheck from Seasick Mama. That's Mariel Marr singing and Dylan Viola accompanying her here in the Soundcheck studio today.
Thanks, Dylan.
Tip Top Shape is the new EP. It was released recently by Seasick Mama. Mariel, this has been great. Thank you very much for coming
in and
playing
for
us.
Thank you for having us. That was a lot of fun.
And now, Soundcheck looks back at the pop charts of yesteryear and asks,
that was a hit?
Everybody was kung fu fighting.
They're coming to take me away, haha.
Joining us this week with another improbable hit song is Mara Eakin, music editor for the AV Club. Hi, Mara.
Hi, John.
So what'd you pick for us today?
I picked Ray Stevens' The Streak, classic 1974 hit.
The Streak. I remember this from when I was a kid. Oh, my God. This was everywhere.
It was. It was It was Stephen's second number one on the Billboard charts, and it spent 3 weeks at number one. And it was even really popular in the UK. And it actually sold 5 million copies, which is a lot of people buying singles of The Streak.
Of The Streak. For folks who aren't familiar with the song, this is what we're talking about.
Well, yes, they call him The Streak. Fast thing on 2 feet. He's just as proud as he can be of his anatomy. He gonna give us a peek. Well, yes, they call him The Streak. Like to show off his physique. If there's an audience to be found, he'll be streaking around, inviting public critique.
That's a little bit of The Streak by Ray Stevens, and yes, that was a hit. As Mara Eakin of the AV Club was telling us, 3 weeks at number one, 17 weeks on the charts in the spring of 74. Give us a little bit of context, Mara. What's this song about?
Well, the song capitalized on the streaking movement, which was popular at the time. Someone streaked the Oscars that year. A little later that year, it was the first sports event streaking. But in March, at the University of Georgia, 1,500 students streaked.
Mm-hmm.
So it was about that.
Streaking being running without your...
Running nude.
Running naked yeah. through a ball field or school campus or what have you.
Yeah.
So somebody
and I'll hang out.
So somebody actually made it onto the stage of the Oscars broadcast that spring?
Yes, Robert Opel or Opel.
Really? You actually know his name?
And it was voted the number one most memorable Oscars moment.
And I'm sure it did not hurt sales of Mr. Stevens' song. So looking back at this, Mara, I mean, do you think really? That was a hit? Or does it kind of make sense given what was going on back then?
I think it makes sense a little bit that it was a hit. I think that now it would be one of those meme-type hits, those internet video-type mm-hmm. hits. But at the time, it sold 5 million copies, which that's an insane amount of copies of a song, a silly song. It's actually 7 minutes long before the radio edit about just running nude and a guy singing in a funny voice.
Right. And of course there were news breaks as well. Let's hear one of those from Ray Stevens' song The Streak.
Hello everyone, this is your Action News reporter with all the news that is news across the nation. On the scene at the supermarket, there seems to have been some disturbance here. Pardon me, sir, did you see what happened?
Yeah, I did. I was just standing over there by the tomatoes and here he comes. Running through the pole beans, through the fruits and veggies, naked as a jaybird. Ethel's over there in the jams, jellies, preserves, and pickles. I hollered over there. I said, "Don't look, Ethel!" She dropped a whole jar of kumquats and fell back into the sweet midget sire. Had us too late. She'd done been incensed.
So perhaps the only number one Billboard hit to continuously break away for alleged news coverage. That is from The Streak by Ray Stevens, 1974 song. That was a hit. Mara Eakin, music editor for the AV Club, joining us on the line. What do we know about Ray Stevens?
Well, Ray Stevens started making songs in the late 50s, and he's still making music to this day. But weirdly, he's made basically an equal number of funny songs, like Ahab the Arab and Harry the Hairy Ape, like novelty singles,
right,
and serious songs. Like one of his other biggest songs was a gospel song. And now he makes kind of right-wing songs that are anti-Obama. So and then he puts them on YouTube.
Okay.
So, but he's pretty famous and he sold a lot of records.
Yeah, and so a lot of novelty. I mean, Ahab the Arab, that was a big hit, what, maybe in the 60s or something?
Yeah, it was like in the early 60s, yeah.
Yeah. Not necessarily the most politically correct stuff, but, you know.
No.
So these were novelty songs. But The Streak had the advantage of also being kind of newsworthy. And it was, I guess at the end of the day, I mean, it was kind of funny, wasn't it?
It's definitely funny. I mean, especially now, if you watch the video, I remember getting into the song. I was born after 74, or at least I had a consciousness after 74. But I remember I know this song because it would be on those TV commercials about, like, wacky compilation CDs that you could buy with funny songs on them. And the video, they always showed the video for this, and I was always like, oh, that song is pretty funny.
I never knew there was a video to it. Was it made later?
I'm sure it was made
later. Okay. Yeah, that figures.
It's on YouTube.
So our narrator is, you know, is in these various places where the news reporter tells us that the streaking is going on. First of all, Ray Stevens, which voice or voices are his?
He's like all the voices.
He's all of them. Okay.
Yeah, he's all the voices.
And so, you know, at every turn, he's trying to protect his wife, Ethel, from seeing the streaker as he goes running by.
Yeah, don't look, Ethel.
And then there's a big twist at the end of the song, right?
The big twist is that Ethel streaks herself and joins in at the basketball game.
Oh, yes, they call him the streak.
Whoa, here he comes again.
Fastest thing,
who's that with? Ethel, is that you, Ethel? Where do you think you're going?
Well, as improbable as it seems, that was a hit. Mara Eakin joining us for our occasional series. She's music editor for the AV Club. Mara, thanks very much.
Thank you.
On Monday's show, as the release date for the new Coen Brothers movie Inside Llewyn Davis approaches, we'll talk with the duo behind the Takeaways Movie Date podcast about the best fictional bands or artists portrayed in the movies. Tell us about your favorite fake movie bands on Twitter or Facebook. Plus, musician, illustrator, and author Marcellus Hall stops by with his band to play a couple of songs from his new album, Afterglow. Don't forget, the 12 days of Soundcheck start on Monday as well. Go to soundcheck.org every day to download some of our favorite tracks recorded right here in our studio this year. It's like an advent calendar for music nerds. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.